listeners, and welcome to another week of the podcast. This week, I interview a good friend, Chris Duffy, and there's a little bit of a funny story in this. I get to confess something that I've been carrying since high school, and since most of you know how old I am, that means decades. It means decades, but I got it off my chest, and thank goodness for that. It's a pretty funny story, and I think it'll demonstrate to you just how wily I was at that very young age. Chris and I have been friends for such a long time, and I've just been enthralled and ever so excited about the direction his life has taken him. Right now, he's the director of Masterpiece Ministries at Chapel Street Church. And part of his ministry includes running the program for those with disabilities. And we have a really lively discussion about what disability looks like, what the definition is, and is the old definition even appropriate anymore? We chat a little bit about the new thinking and the new theology around what disability looks like and what it means. I need to thank everyone who subscribed to the podcast. Please do share this podcast with your friends. It's so very important to getting the word out. And if you haven't yet, please rate or write a little review of the podcast on whatever platform you listen. All right, it's time for episode 131 and my interview with Chris Duffy.
But then in that process of him going through these different facilities for treatment, the example of co-laboring in that story is he had guys that he worked with, like Luke Abbs, nonverbal, Brandon, nonverbal, Jasper, verbal, but a young little kid. And their parents would actually take them to visit my son in rehab. And it kind of gave him something to look forward to and live for. And you know, the narrative is that, yes, Noah, they need you, but you also need them.
Yeah, I mean, historically, I have been known as the grumpy but helpful person. I like to think of it as that I'm stoic, but I'm definitely historically like an introvert, like on the Myers-Briggs and all that. I basically score as a serial killer. So yeah, I'm very introverted. I also, like, growing up, didn't necessarily realize this, but probably have, or not probably, like some learning disabilities and neurodivergent in certain ways that I've learned to kind of code switch and just like operate and get around. So that's like, personality wise, that's probably the core of my personality. Is I definitely am an introvert. I'd much rather sit at my house and read or do things like that than even go out and visit people at a bar. And then in terms of like professionally, the job that I originally had in the professional world, I just did that because it just paid the bills. Like I went to school for computer engineering and I was just naturally kind of mathematically gifted. And I didn't hate it, but it also brought me no like joy or fulfillment. I didn't think that I'm also probably like bordering on communist or socialist. So then in terms of like my belief structure or whatever, I'm definitely just a monotheist, right? I've been a Christ follower since probably sophomore year in high school. And so all the baggage that comes along with that growing up in what would have been probably the mid 80s all the way to current day. And like denominationally, like I'm not a guy I've attended mainline churches. So like I've had exposure to that. I was married in a mainline church. But most of my time has been put in what most people, which is just an awesome thing to share in 2023, is like the evangelical church, you know? And in that space is where I've spent most of my time in terms of like spiritually. And then in that space, I'm also the guy that I just don't know where I've ever fit in either. So there's always been that challenge, whether that be like in the area that I live in is fairly affluent. We're not necessarily that affluent, or like even appearances, like I'm a little fluffy and tattoos and things like that, or even some of my, not just politically, but like theologically, I'm probably a little bit more what most people would consider liberal, more so than toeing the conservative line of whatever school of theology you want to argue about type of thing. And all of that to say that, so most of my life has been spent not necessarily thinking about what I'm going to do in my career. I'm also kind of just a dumb old hippie that just kind of like meanders through life. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I just think that there's a lot of times where I just am willing to show up, and then that opens up different opportunities, right? But also have to be fully acknowledged that I'm not terribly intentional about all of those things. Like some people really plan things out. That is not me.
I love that answer. And you know, you and I initially met decades ago now, I have to say, decades ago in youth group. And I believe my sister and I went to youth group, but I believe other friends from high school it was high school or junior high at that point. And we went for a couple years, and I have to tell you, you know, it was really my first experience with youth group as a, I don't know, I guess young teen. And I had no idea of the drama inherent in that little group of kiddos. First of all, it was so intimidating because, you know, I was from Batavia and y'all were from, it was kids from Geneva, St. Charles, like these really super cool cities where the kids were kind of affluent and just aloof kind of, because they were way cooler. That's how I perceived it as a kid back then. So there was like a lot of pressure to perform, I thought. But there was also, it got pretty intense in that youth group. I don't know if you had that same experience.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up in what people in my world call a churched family. Like my parents didn't go to church. A friend of mine's mom just started dragging me like between my eighth grade and freshman year. And I'm still proud. We went out to dinner with her just last Thursday. So I'm still friends with her. She's 82. And so Mrs. Strucker's the one that started dragging me. So I had like not a totally similar experience. It was also like weird for me because even though I was in St. Charles, I was not necessarily affluent. And then the other challenge is that I am not good at any sporting activity or any, like, I'm not a jock. I was like art, sculpture, photography. And so I didn't necessarily fit in not only socially at high school probably, but also even in the church, because I didn't understand all of the quote unquote, the rules that exist within a church that aren't even like theological, right? They're more just like social. This is kind of how the pecking order works. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely interesting to have a bunch of wealthy, and especially all of us were wealthy when you look at it from a global perspective, right? Like back in the day, the town you grew up in, people probably thought like, oh, Batavia is like the lower income of those three towns that we mentioned, which is simply not true now. And even if you look at it then, in terms of the population of other parts of the country and other parts of the world, we were all ridiculously wealthy and entitled and things like that. So those dynamics definitely were interesting. And it was interesting to see, since I was new to all of that, I didn't see it as performative or like that I was having to do certain things, but I definitely know that was a part of the culture, like that. There were more just expectations that people were trying to either live up to or attain, as opposed to finding that pathway to something at the end, right? It wasn't necessarily the journey. It was about how did I look standing in line for the journey.
I think you went on this, that winter like retreat that we went up where it was snowing, and we went like, I don't know if we went skiing, we went tubing, and it was like Wendy Hanslick was there. I don't know what church it was. Maybe you don't remember this. We went snowmobiling. Were you part of that whole thing?
I don't know. I would like to say yes, just because of the names that were involved, but I don't remember.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
I've been on so many of them. Plus I'm 53 years old, man. Like I can barely remember what I had for breakfast.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that was always a part of it too. That was fun for me now as I've gotten older, to realize I was not a mature human being until like way, way late in my life. Right. But also I was socially inept. I don't know. That's probably why I was so good at computer engineering, right? Because I could go into a room of people and talk to 30 people, but they didn't care about how I said it. They just cared about what I said. So that was always fun in high school because I just say inappropriate things at the wrong times. And
well, I have to tell you, you know, you and I dated for a few months, and I have to say that when we went out and hung out or did whatever we did, I had no idea you were such an introvert. You're such a good conversationalist, so funny, so engaging, one-on-one, I guess. Maybe you're better one-on-one, like who knows? I just remember, you know, opening the door and there you were in that sweet little red car. Oh my God, that red car. I was like, this thing's a death trap.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is just that, I shouldn't use the word code switching because I think that has a different connotation for other people, right? But it is just learning how to fake it till you make it to a certain extent, right? You try little things, you're like, that didn't really work. You don't know why it didn't work. And then, you know, continuing to go, move along.
Well, I do want to just say that you will laugh when you hear what haunts me. Maybe gave the worst, I don't know if it was birthday or Christmas gift in the history of humanity to you, because I had to buy you a gift. I can't remember what the occasion was. And I went to the mall. I was freaking out because I had no idea what to get you. I walked around the mall for like ever. I was just so desperate. You have no idea how desperate I was. And I was like, so I picked this. Oh my God, I can finally get this off my chest. I picked this framed print of the Sea of Tranquility on the moon. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And I gave it to you and you were like, what is this? And I was
there. There's that filter that I don't have.
I was like, this represents I was freaking out. I'm like, this is like when the astronauts went to the moon and they took this picture or something, and it represents the beginning of our relationship. I mean, I literally have been thinking about that for decades, of how I lied to you and made it up so that you didn't think the gift was weird. So now I can confess that and get it off my chest. So there you go.
There you go. 30 plus years later. Yeah. I don't know.
Do you forgive me?
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it until this moment, so we're good.
Well, thank God. Sometimes I wonder if he still has that exquisite framed print of the Sea of Tranquility. Probably not. So intrigued. You know, you didn't grow up in a religious household. This really wonderful, kind woman kind of, you said, dragged you along and dragged you to a youth group, I think I understand, is what you're saying. And then just like from this non-religious background, how did Christianity capture you or speak to you so that it became something you wanted to learn more about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot packed in there. I think part of it probably just is a perfect recipe on the superficial side of like, my family is fairly dysfunctional in terms of like substance abuse and some mental health challenges and things like that. But then on the other hand, growing up, I kind of thought that was typical of most households. And then as I started to see that it wasn't, then what I was exposed to was evangelical Christianity.
Like, take the family background and then the exposure to that. And it kind of just opened up a new doorway in terms of like seeing things that historically in my family, in context of what I grew up in, I had never been exposed to. I think there's also the divine part of it, that there's God who's pulling you in that direction, because like, I do not subscribe to the theology of just pick yourself up by your bootstraps, because I would just be mired in mud. So I think the combination of that, those two things really intrigued me through high school. And I would say that through high school, like in the classic evangelical word, you'd be like, oh, when were you saved? That type of stuff. I would probably put that date sometime in high school, but I would say it wasn't probably until out of high school where I actually understood and kind of had like understood those dynamics in terms of like what we would call like sanctified and transformed and things like that. Up until that point, I think it was more just, I don't want to just limit it to bells and whistles, but there were probably a lot of bells and whistles that were a component of that. And then the other thing is I've never, like, I've read a lot on mysticism and different things like that, probably because of the way that my brain works. Like, I'm really apprehensive to even like, I'm not putting these things in that same category, but in terms of emotional manipulation or like things like that just doesn't ever, it's never resonated with me. Generally, I just kind of giggle because I'm, you know, socially immature and I'm just like, what are you talking about? So that's kind of probably what drew me in, was just, it was seeing that there was something different in terms of than what I was experiencing already in my own like familial unit type of thing.
Okay, here's a question. You say that the mystical part of, you know, doesn't really attract you or interest you. Do you believe in ghosts?
Let's put it this way. I don't believe in aliens. I don't believe in Bigfoot or Yeti. And I don't think I would land anywhere on ghosts for yes or no. Do you know what I mean? So there's my answer.
I appreciate your response, because, you know, I certainly have had one guest in particular who, you know, seen Sasquatch twice in his life. And then of course I've had a few people who've seen ghosts.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting to just interview, well, everyone's different experiences and what they consider to be magical or miraculous. You know, I've said this before, when I started the podcast, I had my one idea of what a miracle was. It's like no one else's idea. No one. And so it's been really interesting hearing people's stories and finding out what they consider to be magical.
Yeah, I mean, and that, and like back to like just even that question, like I don't necessarily know if I would say no, just because I don't, like, that would seem ridiculous to be like, nope, doesn't exist. But I can also say I haven't, like, it's never been anything in my realm of that I've experienced, you know. Now, if somebody came up and told me that they did, I wouldn't say you're wacky. You know what I mean? I do tell my one friend that tries to take me to the land between the lakes to look at Bigfoot that he's out of his mind, but that's a different topic.
Maybe he just wants to go camping with you.
Maybe. No, he says I have to go by myself because that's when they'll come out.
Okay, that sounds dangerous. Don't go. Well, I guess we can segue to, I would love to hear any stories where you feel like you've experienced something, you know, maybe magical is the wrong word, but.
No, I mean, I think those words are okay, because I'm not opposed to it. It's just that the way that, like, just like if I go to a concert, right? Like, I will be the guy that stands there because I don't even know how to like, it's not in me to have that movement with me. You know what I mean? So it's that foreign to do to think of some of those things. Does that make sense? So it's not that I don't believe that people don't dance. I'm just like, I don't dance. I mean, I would say one of them is even just the fact of kind of the transformation that got me kind of to the space I'm in right now, because I would argue that, again, if I look at it, like if I step outside and look, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, there's no reason to be in that space. So that would be one of them, right? Like I would say that, like, I didn't, historically, I haven't had a background as a teacher, a SPED teacher, or any of that stuff. I haven't necessarily been impacted by disability in my life. I mean, obviously, that's not true, because I probably have, but to a far less significant amount than others. And I also don't look like the typical guy that works at, maybe now I do, because it seems like everybody's in the whole tattoos and beard, but historically, I don't put forward that appearance of somebody that's where they would land, working with from birth to 49 people impacted by disability. So I think that's one of them. It's very, like, I would say that's a surprise for some people when they find out that that's the space I'm in. Some people might call it a miracle. Some people might even call it magical. Most people, it's probably a surprise.
Well, I would love to talk more. Could you please talk just a little bit more about the work that you're doing and what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm the director or pastor of disability ministry at our church, which has, we've got four campuses now. And in the Chicagoland area, we're probably in the disability space. We're kind of, have historically, not by my doing, but by another lady that started the ministry, kind of ahead of the curve in terms of churches that support people that are impacted by disability. And so, again, it runs from birth till my oldest friend Stephanie's 49. John Simmons is 42. So it's not just little kids. And it runs from just supporting them in terms of, like, we have sensory rooms for kids that need sensory rooms, or if they're medically fragile. But really, it also is figuring out how to get them into typical programming, and whether that's with a buddy or a little extra support, and things like that. And so that's pretty much my gig there. It also involves respite care for families. So on one Saturday a month, drop your kids, all your kids, not just those impacted by disability, for 4 hours. And we generally have between 50 and 100 kids. And then it's just all one-on-one. Like, we call people with disabilities VIPs, and we call people that are coming alongside them buddies. So you'll have VIPs and buddies paired together. So that's kind of the day-to-day, just like rigmarole of programming. And we've got kids that are in junior high and in high school that require different levels of support. Like, some of it is one-on-one. Some of it is of more coaching in terms of social cues or things like that, that they're not able to maybe regulate as well, or don't understand people's personal space issues and things like that. So on a day-to-day, like, that's the job description. But then the other part of the job is really educating and equipping our staff, and then all the other congregants of what in our theology is kind of the point of disability, and what does that look like? It's not because we feel sorry for them, or it's not because somebody in their life has sinned, or, like, that's not how I roll. And so really, it takes people along essentially a spectrum of starting in ignorance and then moving up to co-laboring with somebody. So we're not just there for a pity party or there to babysit. We're there to figure out, how does this person fit into this context and be able to, you know, both serve and worship and do all of those things. And some of them are cognitive disabilities, some of them are physical, some of them it's a combination. That's kind of on a high level the way I roll.
It's actually really fascinating. When I started seminary, I knew nothing. And one of the women in my cohort had actively for years and years in Texas worked with disabled individuals and advocating for them, sort of social justice for equal, you know, whether it was pay or access, whatever. And I'd never understood before, I guess, at that time, you know, it was kind of this really nascent thing where disabled people were saying, hey, you know, every the language out there around us is that we are less than, so we need to be helped. But by the way, we're totally as good as you. We're totally fine. We can handle most things as well as you. And we are not, you know, don't pity us. We're perfectly fine the way we are. And I really hadn't considered that idea. Not that I thought disabled people were less than, but it was just outside of my life experience. And it really made me understand and helped me to understand that there was a whole world out there that I hadn't had exposure to that I really needed to learn about. The other thing during our gathering days, our first 10 days together as a cohort, we had this fascinating, fascinating class called basically the body in Christianity. And one of the points that was brought up was, you know, during the crucifixion, Jesus is obviously has the nails put into, and then he's cut in his chest. And then he comes back. He rises again after 3 days and with the wounds. And anyone today looking at a human being or a person with wounds like that would say they're disabled, right? Because how much work can you do with your hands, you know, if they, and your feet and ankles, if they've been hurt in that way. And so we have this really lively and fascinating discussion about disability. And could you classify Jesus as disabled after he rises? And I just thought, I was like, oh my God, again, something else I hadn't considered. So fascinating. And we had a great, great conversation around it. Of course, that conversation can go 10,000 different directions. But for me, it really helped me to think of just the world and Jesus' story in a different way, but also just about disability in a different way. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to, I can almost guarantee the book that stemmed from. I was trying to look at the answer because that is one, it's a niche that people can go down specific to. Again, if you're a monotheist and believe in that whole life after death and all of that, of people that are disabled, will those disabilities be there after they die, right? And your topic of, well, when Jesus was resurrected, those physical disabilities were still there. So that's, and you could go a million different ways on both sides, but it is interesting in that, there's a book, I think it's called The Disabled Jesus. I think she was one of the first ladies that wrote real theology. She wrote real like disability theology. I can find it and send it to you. It was fascinating. She like a little bit more liberal in theology than I am, but it's a really good book. And it really does bring into that context of as opposed to seeing people as less than, right? Or lacking something. It really gets to that. Again, those five stages, you start at ignorance and pity, then friendship, care, co-laboring, right? Is really finding, getting to that level of co-laboring to figure out where is it that person like truly fits in and truly belongs and isn't just being served, but is given the ability to serve, right? And finding examples of that is probably one of the biggest parts of at least the mental space in my head for my job is trying to figure out and navigate what that looks like.
I mean, I would think with your job, you know, one of the miracles is friendship, you know, and meeting all these new people. And everyone, of course, has a story or an experience that they bring with them that kind of informs how they are in the world at any given moment. But I would imagine just gaining trust is a huge part of your job.
Yeah, I mean, like another, like a miracle. And again, I don't necessarily know if I would use the word miracle or magical or whatever, but definitely fits in that space was, and so some of this is my son's story to tell, but like my son is in recovery now, but was not in recovery for a long time and was a substance abuser and had mental health challenges. and went through like five or six different rehabs and stays in the psych ward and things like that. But my son is the reason that I started volunteering with people with disabilities was because of him, because he wanted to do it and he couldn't do it because he wasn't old enough unless I got dragged along, right? So I showed up. But then in that process of him going through these different facilities for treatment, the example of co-laboring in that story is he had guys that he worked with, like Luke Abbs, nonverbal, Brandon, nonverbal, Jasper, verbal, but a young little kid, and their parents would actually take them to visit my son in rehab. And it kind of gave him something to look forward to and live for. And, you know, the narrative is that, yes, Noah, they need you, but you also need them. And so, yeah, I'll get a little leaky and may cry a little, but, and so if we could use the word miracle, I don't know what word I would use, but that's an example of co-laboring or of seeing somebody's value for more than what it just appears on the outside.
I mean, I would use the word beautiful. Oh my goodness. Honestly, that's such a beautiful story. And bless your son's heart that he'd touch these people so deeply that they wanted to continue in friendship and relationship with him. I did love your second use of the word dragged, because it seems like when you're dragged, like first it was to youth group and now it's to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that also is part of my, when I say just show up, right? Like sometimes it is getting dragged someplace, but I think being uncomfortable in spaces and being proximal to people that you aren't comfortable with. And it doesn't just have to be in disability. It can be in any, like whatever. I think opening yourself up to those opportunities, even if you're dragged there, right? I think that's where you see people make the most growth and change in their life, right? As if they're open to that.
Well, I was thinking it's when you're dragged there is when the miracles are happening in your life.
Probably.
Or they start. It's like, that's when the miracles start for you. Well, are you surprised at where you're at in your vocation? Like, is it surprising for you? Could you envision where you are right now?
The only surprising part is just the fact that I'm still at that church that you and I, like, at some point attended youth group. That's a little bit surprising. But I went to Bible school, right, before I went to college, never intending necessarily to go into ministry or anything like that. And then I have been involved serving in different capacities. Like before the disability stuff, what our family did as a group was like worked with and supported refugees and things like that. So it's not terribly surprising, because I kind of, for whatever reason, have always been interested in finding the people whose lives aren't necessarily ideal and trying to figure out like why and how can we possibly help, right? And not necessarily just in material ways, but find those people that are being, in a lot of times, being oppressed, and then making a case for, hey, all you Bible thumpers, your theology says this and you're acting like jackwagons, you know, we kind of need to fix that, right? Like, so I would say not surprising, because I've done a lot of weird stuff in my life. Like, you know, I don't know. It would probably more surprising that I actually worked for Arthur Anderson, the accounting firm, right? That's probably more surprising to me.
Okay. Can I use the word jackwagons?
Yeah.
Okay. And every time I use it, I'll attribute it to you.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go.
And I'll send you 50 cents.
All right. I'll be a billionaire soon.
Thank you so much for this conversation. Do you have any other like miraculous stories you want to tell?
No, I mean, as I think of things, like one of the things that's fairly interesting and is the disability space. And as I recently talked to a group about like 70 people about this to kind of give them like a 101 on what it really looks like to be deal with disability in the church and what that should look like and what we're doing wrong. And if you use certain words, how I'll probably punch you, like things like that. And as I went through that and prepared for it, I thought back to some of the kids, like when I was younger. And at the time, if you would have asked me when I was 14 or 20, do you have any friends that are disabled? I'd be like, no. But I can go back and name those people that all the way back to when I was like 14, who were, that I was proximal to, and kind of, I would say, like, even though I was unaware of it, softened my heart up to that space all along until the point where I am today, right? And I think part of what goes into that too for me is that as I look at, like, not only is it like the classic disability that people might think of as like somebody that uses a wheelchair or somebody that doesn't speak or is nonverbal, depending on what part of the country you're in, they use different terms. But all the way to like seeing like mental health challenges that people might have, or realizing that like substance abuse and addiction isn't a moral failing, it's a medical condition. And what does that look like? So I think having that perspective, and then I've lost more people than I would like to acknowledge to substance abuse. And kind of navigating through that and still coming out the other end somewhat hopeful. Like even just during COVID, one of my locker partner from high school took his own life, and he'd only been sober 8 years, right? And so seeing those stories, on one hand, they made me want to put a blanket over your head and just be like, Duffy out, right? But really seeing them in the grand picture of how they've impacted either my life or my son's life or other people that I know. And so those, though they, all of them didn't end like the fairy tale story, I do see those as little miracles that were sprinkled along to, I don't know, help give me a little wisdom, give me a little hope, right? And see those things. Because I think without them, it's very easy to then just put on the glasses of like, America's a Christian nation. And we, like, all of the diatribes that are going on out there right now, it's so easy to have that when you don't spend the time to actually look at those people that are actually suffering and have suffered around you and figure out how do you navigate that with them and alongside them.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoy Chris. You've gotten to know him a little bit. You've gotten to know one of my super, super dark secrets from high school. I hope you don't judge me too much, and I hope it provided you with a laugh. I am going to provide a link to a really wonderful documentary called Crip Camp. It's on Netflix right now, and it'll be on the Treasures page of the website. I urge all of you to watch the documentary, and I think you'll get a little dose of the conversations around disability right now and what so many human beings are doing to kind of change that conversation and shift perceptions around disability and what those with disabilities look like. I need to thank Chris for being so generous and agreeing to be on the podcast. And then I need to thank him for forgiving me for what I did in high school. Thanks, Chris. And then I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Frank Schroeder, Alexander Nakarada, Stephen O'Brien, Winnie the Moog, Music L Files, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to my Patreon. Yes, thank you to all my subscribers. My goal right now is to get 25 Patreon subscribers. So please, please consider supporting me at either the $3 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month level.
All of your donations help me defray the costs to put this podcast out in the world. And of course, I'm ever so grateful to my current Patreon subscribers. You'll never know how much it means to me. And of course, as I always say on the website, you'll find links to groovy artists, to books, to playlists, to other items I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Chris. Go to places that might make you uncomfortable. Do things that challenge you, that make you feel nervous or maybe excited. Go to places that test your edges. And you never know. You never know what kind of gold or magic you'll get from those places. You'll retrieve from those places. That golden magic, it's priceless. And it'll change you forever in all the best ways. So do uncomfortable things, test your edges, and be like Chris. Use those nuggets of gold, those nuggets of wisdom, to go out and make this world a shinier place.